It's always a sensitive time here in Israel and Palestine. Currently, there has been a renewed surge in violence in the West Bank, Jerusalem, and other towns inside the Green Line. Today on Shtetl Middle East, we talk with Gershon Baskin, a man involved with Arab-Jewish relations and peace negotiations for over 30 years, for his perspective on what some people fear might be a third intifada. You can download this or past episodes of Shtetl on the Shortwave from iTunes or at shtetlmontreal.com.
Shtetl on the Shortwave.
Welcome to Shtetl on the Shortwave on CKUT 90.3 FM. I'm your host, Tamara Kramer, coming to you from Tel Aviv. Passions are running high here in Israel and Palestine. There's random violence, protests, and in some places, it's just life as usual. It's actually a bit confusing and it's hard to find my footing and to know what to think or what to do about it all. Being here does help. It helps to hear the news, to talk to Jewish people and to Palestinians, to see and read the fearful, destructive first-person accounts of the ongoing violence of the occupation, to see the hateful Facebook posts, and to read the ones from frustrated and desperate Palestinians and Jews and others who continue to seek peace. I do see people wringing their hands to untangle the puzzle of fear, of Middle Eastern politics, of national and religious identity. How can we all live together? What will it take? Can it work? Next week, there will be elections in Canada, and I'm amazed and sad to see that Israel and Palestine are used as a reason to vote for one side over another. From supporting Prime Minister Stephen Harper because of his simplistic, one-sided support of Israel, to posting signs about how Melker is a Zionist pig, and to see religion in the form of the debate over the niqab used as a wedge issue. How can we play with freedom of religion like that when I see how fear of the other can lead to bloody deaths over here? I wonder how Canadian politicians can be so irresponsibly divisive to use language like barbaric cultural practices to talk about citizens and newcomers to Canada. It's hard to believe. As naive as it may sound to some, I wish people would stop fueling the hatred and understand that people here need to find hope and common ground, not be victimized by more hatred, whether it's of Palestinians or of Israeli Jews from the other side of the ocean. Because a lot of the violence is happening in Jerusalem. I felt a bit apprehensive yesterday when I traveled there to speak with Gershon Baskin, a prominent voice for peace in Israel and Palestine. His is only one perspective, based on over 30 years of working to bridge the gap between Arab and Jewish communities. He's known for his work as the negotiator who freed Israeli soldier Gilad Shalit from Hamas. He's the founder of the Israel-Palestine Center for Research and Information, an advisor to governments on the peace process, and he's on the board of organizations like the Palestinian Israeli Journal. Gershon Baskin is a Zionist, an atheist, and a firm believer that both Jews and Palestinians deserve to be at home in this small stretch of land. I want to start the show with this song by David Broza featuring Wyatt Clef Jean. Stay tuned for a feature interview with Jerusalem Post columnist and Middle East peace negotiator Gershon Baskin. But first, East-West Jerusalem.
Same face in Jericho, it's the same face I see down in the
On Shtetl on the Shortwave on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal, coming to you from Israel and Palestine. This is a feature interview with Gershon Baskin, one of the household names here when it comes to the peace process. I spoke with him yesterday in Jerusalem.
I'm Gershon Baskin. I am the founder of IPCRI, which is now called the Israel-Palestine Creative Regional Initiatives. In addition to that, I'm a solar energy entrepreneur working with an American-owned Dutch company based in Jerusalem for developing solar energy projects in the developing world, and I'm the country manager for Palestine and for Egypt. I'm the member of the board of five other Israeli-Palestinian joint peace organizations, political social activist.
And how long have you lived here in Israel?
Going on 38 years.
And what made you decide to come move here?
Came after I finished my BA. I'm a Zionist. Israel is my home. I always felt at home in Israel. I love this country and care about it dearly. And there's no other place in the world I'd rather live.
So what made you decide to start this organization, IPCRI?
My political activism history goes back to the time that I was a little kid, growing up in the United States in the 1960s. When I was really, really young, like around 10 years old, we visited Williamsburg, Virginia. We were living in New York, and it was a few months before the U.S. Congress passed the Civil Rights Act, which made racism in America illegal. But while visiting Williamsburg, Virginia, I saw a restaurant that had signs in the window that said whites only, and that really shocked me. My mother was a teacher, and when we got back to New York, she gave me a book to read. That was a best-selling popular novel during the time called Black Like Me. It's a book written by an American journalist who was a white man who injected himself with some kind of chemicals that turned his skin dark. Mm-hmm. And he wrote a book of what it was like to be a black man in America. And that had a big impact on me. I was around 12 years old. I started getting involved politically in the civil rights movement and the anti-war movement. I grew up in a very Jewish neighborhood on Long Island, 90% Jewish. I had one non-Jewish friend. When I was 14 years old, we moved to another town that was very non-Jewish, 3% Jews. My first week in school, I was invited by a Jewish schoolmate to join Young Judea. They were setting up Young Judea in our town. I didn't know what it was, and I didn't know what Zionism was, but I thought it was a nice place to meet Jewish girls. somewhere along the line, after spending a year in Israel after high school and coming back, and I was on the Young Judea year course program, very intensive Zionist experience, came to the realization that here I was planning already to make Aliyah, planning to come and live in Israel. And I spent this whole year there, and I didn't even speak to an Arab once. I was becoming more and more aware about the Israeli-Arab conflict, understood that I had a huge gap in my knowledge, my understanding of what this conflict was about, what Israel was about. I started reading everything I could get my hands on. I read about 100 books the first year about the Israeli-Arab conflict, started trying to talk to Arabs. Around that time, I wrote my first op-ed piece calling for the two-state solution. And when I was planning to make Aliyah, thinking I wanted to be engaged and involved politically, I knew that there was no real starting point for engagement in the Israeli-Palestinian issue, but I was aware of the issue of discrimination against Israeli citizens who were Palestinian Arabs, who at that time were 17% of the population. One of every six Israelis was an Arab. And I heard about a reform rabbi who was creating a new program called Interns for Peace, and he was looking for American Jewish university graduates who would go to Israel and live in Arab villages for 2 years, kind of a Peace Corps program, do community organizing, community work, and developing programs of interaction with nearby Jewish communities. So I signed up for the program, and I made Aliyah to an Arab village.
And did you learn to speak Arabic?
I started to learn to speak Arabic then. I'm still learning to speak Arabic. It is a very difficult, complicated language. And of course, the spoken Arabic is a different language than the written Arabic. And yes, I'm studying Arabic. In fact, I was supposed to have an Arabic lesson today, but the teacher took off for the Islamic New Year.
So that began your time here in Israel as a Jew who was connected to Arab people and Palestinians, and you've continued with friendships with Palestinians throughout your time here?
For sure. Every single day I speak to Palestinians, either who are citizens of Israel or in the territories, the West Bank and Gaza, East Jerusalem. All the time when I was in this program living in the Arab village, we had a visit from a delegation from the county of Los Angeles. Someone in the delegation worked for the county of Los Angeles and told me that his job was to work on ethnic group relations. And he told me that there were more than 160 employees in the county of Los Angeles at this time. This was in the mid-1970s. And I wondered to myself, wow, I wonder how many people are working for the government of Israel involved in improving the relations between the Jewish and Arab citizens of Israel. Of course, I did a little piece of research, which wasn't very difficult to do because the answer was zero. So then I wrote a letter to Prime Minister Menachem Begin and said, as we say in Hebrew, Hineni, here I am. You need to have someone in working in the government of Israel, more than one person, whose job it is to work on the relations, because Israel is a democracy, and in a democracy, all citizens should be equal. And Begin was someone who believed in equality, believed in human rights. And I became the first civil servant in Israel responsible for Jewish-Arab relations, working in the Ministry of Education.
I want to fast forward a little bit. You were well known for having helped with the backdoor negotiations that led to Hamas's release of Gilad Shalit in exchange for the release of thousands of Palestinian prisoners from Israeli jails. How did you come to have a relationship with the leadership of Hamas?
A year before Gilad Shalit was abducted, I was attending a seminar on the future of Jerusalem that was taking place in Switzerland, and I received a phone call from my wife. My wife comes from an Iraqi family, a rather large family, and she told me that one of her first cousins had disappeared, didn't come home from work, and the family knew that he had a small factory for candy outside of Jerusalem in the Mishor Adumim industrial zone. And he was going with one of his Palestinian workers to Ramallah to see some machinery that was for sale, and he didn't come home. So they called me and asked me if I could use my contacts with Palestinians to try and find him. I was outside of Israel. I picked up the phone and called my Palestinian partner and asked him to go to Ramallah to ask around the Palestinian police, Palestinian security forces. He did, he went, and he found nothing. A few days later, Hamas put out a videotape on one of their websites showing my wife's cousin handcuffed, blindfolded, and been tortured. A few days later, the Israeli security found his body thrown on the side of the road. At his funeral in Jerusalem, attended by more than 1,000 people, I stood over his grave, naturally feeling horrible and very sad, but also especially because they asked me to help and I couldn't. I'd been working with Palestinians for more than two decades by then, and there was nothing I could do. And I swore to myself at that time, if anything ever happened and someone came to me and said, help, I wouldn't rest. I would do everything humanly possibly. Fast forward a few months later, I'm attending a conference, a Mediterranean Development Conference in Cairo. I was the only Israeli at the conference. And a Palestinian colleague from Gaza came up to me, a professor of economics at the Azhar University in Gaza, which is a Fatah university, and said to me, Gershon, I want you to meet someone who was a student of mine in the past. He's now a professor of economics at the Islamic University of Gaza, and he's a member of Hamas. He came from Gaza to Cairo because he heard there might be someone at this conference from Israel he'd never talked to an Israeli before. I had never talked to anyone from Hamas before. So it was our opportunity. We went out and spent about 6 hours over the next 2 days talking. We didn't agree about anything. But it was an interesting conversation, and I proposed to him that we continue our dialogue and proposed to him that we include others. He would bring some colleagues. I would bring some colleagues. I would find a third country that would host our talks because we couldn't do it in Israel or Gaza. He agreed. Make a long story short, those talks never came about because the Hamas leadership vetoed them. But we developed a relationship. I went down to Gaza. I met him. I met his colleagues at the Islamic University. We went to the prime minister's office. The Hamas prime minister's office sat with one of the advisors for a couple of hours, trying to convince him to give an okay for the talks. In the end, he said he would join the talks, but he was vetoed and turned down. Anyway, on June 25th, 2006, early in the morning, an attack on the Kerem Shalom army base through a tunnel. Hamas and other fighters that were with them saw a tank at the end of the base, and they shot a rocket-propelled grenade at it. It went up in flame. Two soldiers came out against orders and were shot on the spot and killed, Ilan Barak and Pavel Slutsker. One of the Palestinians climbed up on the tank, threw a hand grenade inside. It blew up inside the tank. And a third soldier came out wounded and was dragged off to Gaza. It was Gilad Shalit. 6 days later, on July 1st, early in the morning, Shabbat morning, I get a phone call from the professor. It says to me, Gershon, we have to do something. We're being bombed. We have no electricity. We have no water. The situation is really bad, and it's going to get worse. So I said to him, his name was Mohammed Migdal. I said, Mohammed, what can we do? He said, why don't we try and arrange a phone call between Hamas people and someone in Israel? Let's open up a channel. And he got in his car and drove to the prime minister's office, and they called me. Half an hour later, I'm on the phone with the spokesperson of the prime minister and his advisor. And from that day on, until Gilad Shalit came home, I would not give up. It took me 3.5 months, September 9th, 2006, to produce the first sign of life from Gilad Shalit, a handwritten letter that was delivered to the Egyptians in Gaza. The following day, I was instructed by the Israelis who were in charge of the file to step down because the Egyptians were taken over. I said to myself, as long as official negotiations are going on, then I won't interfere. But if negotiations aren't going on, or if they're getting stuck or something, I'll see how I can help. And that was basically the story. It took me 5 years to convince the Israeli government to listen to me, to authorize me to negotiate on behalf of Israel. Finally, they did. And a few months later, he was home.
And that was because you managed to convince the Israeli government to release prisoners?
No, the Israeli government had agreed to release 1,000 prisoners for Shalit 6 months after his abduction, but they never agreed to do the deal. There was an agreement. The government of Israel set the number of 1,000 for one. In fact, they agreed that it would be done in two phases, 450 based on a list submitted by Hamas, and then 550 based on a list submitted by Israel and approved by Egypt. But then the government reneged on the deal that they made. When Gilad Shalit came home on October 18th, 2011, that was the deal. 1,000 prisoners, 450 and 550. It was a deal. The whole issue was working out a list that was would be agreed upon, that would mitigate the risks and the dangers to Israel. That was about it. And the reason why the negotiations succeeded was a number of different reasons, but one of the big ones was after 5 years of working together with my counterpart in Hamas, we had developed a trustful relationship between us as individuals. So that after working for a few months ping-ponging back and forth on a document of principles of what was the list going to contain, what kind of people, I proposed to him that we scrap this ping-ponging back and forth and put all our cards on the table. What are your red lines? What are Israel's red lines? And let's agree to the midpoint. And he agreed to that. He almost got in real big trouble for doing that because he exposed what their red lines were. But in the end of the day, that produced document number 7, which the guy from the Mossad who was in charge of the case took to the Prime Minister Netanyahu and got a green light for moving ahead with the deal.
Do you continue to have a relationship with this friend from Hamas in Gaza?
I don't know that I would call him a friend. He's a counterpart. He is someone that I talk to on a regular basis.
Okay. It's complicated, fascinating. But it is a demonstration that it's possible to have a relationship with anybody if you're willing to try, if you're willing to speak, if you're willing to develop trust, that it is possible.
I have a number of mottos or slogans that I've lived by. One of them is that I'll talk to anyone who's willing to talk to me without conditions. I think it's difficult to talk to someone who doesn't recognize your right to exist. People say, could we make peace with Hamas? And my answer is no, because Hamas are not moderates. Hamas are pragmatic. There are a lot of pragmatic people in Hamas who understand that 1.8 million people in Gaza can't survive without some kind of relationship with Israel. So even though they're committed ideologically to the destruction of Israel, they get their water from Israel, they get their electricity from Israel, they get their food and medication from Israel. They're surrounded by Israel. They need to have a relationship with Israel. So they maintain pragmatic mechanisms in order to survive, but they are not moderate in their ideology. The person that I was in contact with now since 2006, 9 years already, is someone who I would define as a moderate, someone who talks about the possibility of peace, someone who's critical of Hamas, even though he's a senior member of Hamas. He has written articles in Hamas newspapers criticizing Hamas's policy. And I think that I can't take credit for his moderation, but I think that the relationship that we have developed over these years has influenced the way that he perceives Israel, which is different than it was 9 years ago.
So I was a bit nervous to take the bus here to do this interview in Jerusalem from Tel Aviv. As somebody who's been here for many decades, do you relate to that? How do you feel in the city right now?
I don't think we have to panic. But I'll tell you, yesterday I was interviewed by CNN, and I had some time before the interview, so I sat down and had a falafel, and I was sitting outside. And all of a sudden, near CNN studios, not far from the central bus station in Jerusalem, and I'm sitting and I felt that my back was really exposed. And I got nervous. And I changed my seat in a way that my back was against the wall so that I had a view all around me. And it turns out, as I was coming out of CNN on the radio, they announced that a stabbing had just taken place at the central bus station, a Palestinian who stabbed a 70-year-old woman. I was 200 meters away from where I was sitting, having my falafel. So, yeah, the city is filled with danger. The country has a lot of danger in it. I remember vividly the Second Intifada. Our children were small. We didn't allow them to ride buses. We drove them everywhere. We bought them cell phones so that we could trace them in every given moment, anytime there was a bus bombing going on. And the sense of terror, the sense of fear that we're feeling today in this country is very similar to what we felt then.
Can you briefly describe what the situation is here for the listeners, what's been happening the last couple of weeks in Israel and Palestine?
We're in one of the waves of violence that sweeps through this country over the last years, decades. People would say even the last 100 years. And each round of violence is a little bit different than the one before it. This one is very intensive, and it's mostly young Palestinians who are not political people. They're not members of organizations or movements. They're not from Hamas or Islamic Jihad or from Fatah, who are taking knives, kitchen knives, butcher knives, and going around and trying to kill Israelis. It's centered on the focus of what's going on is what they claim to be the Israeli changes in Al-Aqsa. Al-Aqsa is what we call the Temple Mount, what some Muslims call Haram al-Sharif, the noble sanctuary. Aqsa relates to the mosque that's at the southern end, but Palestinians and Muslims relate to the whole compound, the whole Temple Mount. And they have claimed that Israel intends to allow Jewish prayer there, to demolish the mosques there and to build the temple. This is all false. But it's based on an increase in Jewish radical right-wing religious people who are demanding from the government of Israel to allow them to go up to the Temple Mount to pray. Traditionally, there has been a religious prohibition by Jews to go up there so as not to desecrate the sanctity of the place where the temple was, where we don't know where the Holy of Holies is. Over the last years, what was a handful of rabbis who said that Jews should go up there, and Jews can go up there. There are areas of the Mount that we know the temple wasn't there and the Holy of Holies wasn't there. What was a handful is today hundreds of rabbis who have thousands of followers who want to change the status quo. In 1967, when Israel conquered East Jerusalem, and the famous announcement, Har HaBayit B'yadeinu, the Temple Mount is in our hands, an Israeli soldier flew a flag from the Dome of the Rock, and Moshe Dayan, who was the Minister of Defense, immediately ordered the flag be removed, convened a meeting of the Muslim sheikhs, the Muslim holy clergy in Jerusalem, and assured them that Israel had no intention to change the status quo on the Temple Mount, meaning that the Muslims would continue to pray up on the Temple Mount. They would have control of their religious institutions, and that Israel would respect that and abide by that and protect it, and that Jews would pray at the Western Wall, the Wailing Wall, down below. That's beginning to change in public opinion in Israel, and the Palestinians are convinced that Israel is tunneling underneath the Temple Mount. There have been cracks in the southern wall of the Temple Mount. There are excavations going on in Silwan, which is below the Temple Mount toward what we call the City of David, and people here tunneling underneath their houses. So I have not found a single Palestinian Muslim in this area who doesn't believe that Israel doesn't have a plan to change the status quo. And that's where we have a huge breach of trust, because it's not just a piece of real estate. This is a nuclear reactor. This could set off an explosion in the whole region that we could not contain. The head of the religious courts in Palestine, head of the Sharia court, Dr. Mahmoud Habash, told me, I asked him, had many discussions with him. He's the senior religious authority in the Palestinian Authority. I asked him about the status of mosques in Sharia law and Islamic law. And he said, from our point of view, according to Sharia, there is no prohibition of Jews praying in a mosque. By the way, in Jewish halakha, in Jewish law, there's no prohibition for Jews to pray in a mosque. And so he said to me that the problem here of Jews praying in Al-Aqsa is not religious, it's political. And it has to do with the occupation and the control of Israel and the domination and the fear and the total mistrust out of 22 years of failed peace process and all the violence that's taken place. So we're in a period where this is being used, inciting the public. Israel has no plans to change the status quo, but no one believes it. So we need to come up with some kind of mechanism which is going to confront the mistrust and provide assurances to the Muslim world and to the Palestinians that Israel is maintaining the status quo and guaranteeing it. And that will have to involve some kind of international monitoring and verification mechanism that says, yes, the situation there is as it should be. Israel is not trying to demolish the mosque or tunnel underneath them. And even though Israel is going to see that as a compromise on its sovereignty, there is going to be no other way to put this current round of violence to sleep, I think, other than accepting some kind of international mechanism.
Do you think Netanyahu will eventually do that?
I think he will have to. If we go back to the last time Al-Aqsa was used as the reason for explosion here, which was back in the end of September 2000, the second Intifada was called the Al-Aqsa Intifada, and it started after the visit of Ariel Sharon on the Temple Mount, which was a provocation against Prime Minister Barak, not against the Muslims, but it was misinterpreted by the Muslims, who thought that Israel was planning to conquer, to take over the mosques. And again, in negotiations that took place that I was actually involved in. I was sitting in Ramallah on the fourth night in the Intifada, together with two members of Knesset, with Ehud Barak on one phone and Yasser Arafat on the other phone. And there were six demands that Arafat made. Israel agreed to five of them, but the sixth one was to have an international commission to investigate what happened on the Temple Mount. And Barak refused because he didn't want to internationalize the conflict. And several months later, Israel agreed at the intervention of the U.S. government to the commission headed by Senator Mitchell. It was called the Mitchell Commission, which came to investigate what happened on the Temple Mount.
Do you ever feel hopeless, or how do you feel towards the leadership in Israel right now?
Well, I always say that despair is not a program. And the fastest path between despair and hope is thoughtful, strategic action. So I get into very, very short periods of despair, a couple of hours, 24 hours, before I figure out the next thing that I'm going to try to do, which is usually knocking my head against the wall, trying to move mountains. I undertook in these last few days an attempt to convince King Abdullah of Jordan that he should take an initiative to convene a meeting of Prime Minister Netanyahu and President Abbas and come up with a declaration on keeping the status quo and putting in an international mechanism. I have a direct channel to the king that I've developed over these years, so he got my messages. I clarified and verified with President Abbas through one of his senior people that if the initiative came from King Abdullah, he would accept it. Now John Kerry is trying to intervene with his own initiative, which I think is a total disaster. The last thing we need here is another American-led peace initiative, which will fail because the Americans don't have the slightest idea of what's really going on here and how to do things here. Even Kerry, what they said on Israeli television about Kerry's initiative, what is he was planning to bring Abbas and Netanyahu to Amman, to the palace, to King Abdullah, but he would not allow the three of them to talk to each other. He was going to shuttle back and forth between rooms, talking to each side separately, which is total idiocy. I mean, the whole point here is that we have to talk to each other.
So you think it's as simple as getting the three...
it's not simple at all. It's very complex and very difficult. What I'm saying is that if the parties here are not forced by reality to take responsibility, there is no third party that can take responsibility and come up with a magic wand and fix the situation here. The parties here are going to have to take responsibility. They're going to have to take responsibility for security and for peace, which means dealing with the issues of settlements, of borders, of water, of economics, of Jerusalem. It has to be coming from the region. What we need from the international community is to apply pressure by creating parameters that would be the basis for a peace agreement. A new Security Council resolution. The last meaningful Security Council resolution on this conflict is Resolution 242 from 1967, or 338 from 1973, which basically was a repeat of 242. We need a new Security Council resolution that would be backed by the United States and the other permanent members of the Security Council that put into place parameters for what Israeli-Palestinian peace looks like. We're talking about preserving the two-state solution, which is, in my mind, preserving the Jewish democratic state of Israel. Israel should be the first country in the world supporting the two-state solution officially, recognizing the state of Palestine. There has to be a timetable for negotiations, because back in 1991, when the Madrid conference took place, under President Bush the father and Mikhail Gorbachev, Yitzhak Shamir, who was prime minister, said in response to a question of why you're going to this peace meeting with all these Arabs, he said, don't worry, we'll negotiate for 20 years and we'll bring another 500,000 Israelis into the Judea and Samaria. And here we are 22 years later, or even longer than that, and we negotiated all those years and there are 500,000 Israelis in Judea and Samaria. Shamir knew what he was talking about. So the Palestinians say no more open-ended negotiations. When Netanyahu waves his magic wand of his rhetoric in the United Nations and says, I call on President Abbas to come to negotiations without conditions, what does that mean? More negotiations while Israel is building more settlements, moving more Israelis into the territories that are supposed to become the Palestinian state, and then we have less and less to talk about? So no conditions actually means that continuing of the conditions that exist on the ground, which is a dead end for a positive negotiation.
So basically you're against the expansion of the settlements?
First of all, settlements are illegal by international law. I don't care what anyone is going to say. There's a handful of international lawyers coming out of Israel and coming out of the Jewish world who say, no, it's not true because the West Bank is not occupied territory because it was occupied by Jordan and they weren't illegal. Sovereign, the Jordanian occupation was illegal, and it wasn't a belligerent occupation because Israel is defending itself. That's all true, but it has zero to do with the fact that the West Bank is occupied territory by international law. And international law is quite clear, both in Security Council resolution and in the Fourth Geneva Convention, that the transference of civilian population into territories occupied is illegal by international law. So we are in contravention of international law. Secondly, it's against Israel's interest. If you want a binational state, build more settlements. If you want Israel to be the nation state of the Jewish people and a democratic state, then we have to end settlements, and we're going to have to deal with the fact that we move so many Israelis into the territory that's supposed to become the Palestinian state. Part of that will be done because the Palestinians have agreed to the concept of territorial swaps. So we can actually annex territories along the Green Line and take into Israel, with about a 4 or 4.5% annexation of the West Bank, about 75% of the settlers who will remain where they are under Israeli sovereignty. But we're going to have to give them land in exchange of equal size that's uninhabited land. So there's about 4 or 4.5% of uninhabited land alongside the Israeli border with the West Bank and Gaza that could be transferred. That's about it. And then we're going to leave between 80 to 100,000 settlers east of the border, and we're going to have to deal with that. Some of them will move to the annexed areas if they want to stay in Judea and Samaria. Some of them will come back to Israel proper. Some of them presumably could apply to be citizens or residents of the state of Palestine, although probably not many would, but that should be a possibility on the table. I would demand it if I were a negotiator, that Jews have the right to live in a Palestinian state. But probably a lot of them are going to have to be forcibly removed. And if we build more houses for them, particularly in the settlements that we know are not going to be part of the state of Israel, we're investing money there, we're moving families there, we're investing lives there, and we're just creating more problems for ourselves. Not only that, the inner settlements, the ones in the hills adjacent to Palestinian towns and cities, are the ones that create the most problems in terms of violence and conflicts with their neighbors. There was something in the paper this morning that the residents of Yizhar, which is one of the most violent settlements, are complaining that the Palestinians are coming out to pick their olives, and their olive trees are too close to Yizhar. As if Yizhar was there for 1,000 years and the Palestinians planted olive trees. It was Yizhar that was planted in the midst of the Palestinian olive trees and not the other way around. Or a minister, the minister of internal security, Erdan, said on the television after the terrorist attack in near Pisgat Ze'ev, he was commenting that the Arabs are surrounding Pisgat Ze'ev. Excuse me, the Arabs were there beforehand. We built Pisgat Ze'ev in the middle of Arab towns. So what do you expect if you build a Jewish neighborhood in Jerusalem, which is a settlement in between Arab towns, that the Arab towns aren't going to be next to the settlement that you're building?
How do most Israelis that you encounter, the average Israelis, how do they react to your opinions about the settlements?
Today, almost no one in Israel believes in the possibility of peace. The more reasonable people talk about managing the conflict, almost no one talks about resolving the conflict today. And that's very much out of a sense of the failure of the peace process and the belief that we have no partner. But because I'm one of those few people who actually travels across these borders almost every day and talks to people on both sides, I hear exactly the same thing from the other side. When you have both sides of conflict saying, we want peace, but we have no partner on the other side, we have a breakdown of trust and confidence, which is based on a failure of the process. It's based on understanding that the agreements were breached by both sides. This isn't a story of the good guys who implemented the agreements with good intentions and the other side who didn't. Both sides breached their agreements. When President Abbas said in the UN that the Oslo agreements are virtually null and void because they're not being implemented by Israel, he was not incorrect. What he didn't say is that we Palestinians are also not implementing our commitments. When I make a presentation and have the time to actually explain these things, the first reaction I get from Israelis is, why don't we know this? There's just so many things, so much information, so many facts, so many interpretations of facts that they don't know, that they're not exposed to. There are many people who think I'm naive. I think I'm very non-naive. There's nothing naive about my approach. I say that the failure of the peace process doesn't mean that it's not possible. It means we have to be a lot smarter about going about it. And we have to understand that we won't have security until they do, that we won't have real sovereignty, particularly in the city of Jerusalem, until they do. You know, we declare sovereignty in Jerusalem. There's not a country in the world that recognizes Israel's sovereignty in Jerusalem. In the 1800s, you could float around in a ship in with a British flag and land someplace and claim sovereignty, and if you had the might to enforce it, that was fine. In the 20th and 21st centuries, sovereignty is only recognized bilaterally or multilaterally. We can claim all the sovereignty we want in Jerusalem, but we don't have it. There's not one embassy in the city of Jerusalem. So we can declare it our capital, but no one recognizes it as our capital. The only time that Jerusalem will be recognized as the capital of Israel is when it's also recognized as the capital of Palestine. So we have lots of reasons, lots of interest for trying to figure this out. But I refuse to accept the idea that it's impossible. This is based on human relations. We need to change the human relations between the people of Israel and the people of Palestine. It has to start at the level of leadership, because we have to have a political agreement before we can build reconciliation between people. But we also have to build peace, which is based on open borders, eventually. On the idea, not the idea that Oslo was us here and them there, and we're going to have walls, fences, and barbed wires between us. That's not peace. Peace has to have a vision where people are actually interacting, getting to know each other, working together, commerce, scientific exchange, academic exchange, cultural exchange, people crossing borders, knowing each other, learning each other's language. How is it Hebrew and Arabic are so close to each other and we don't speak each other's language?
Two questions. Do you think that most Israelis have an idea of what's happening in the occupied territories? Do they know what it's like there for the Palestinians who live there?
No. I think that most Israelis choose ignorance. Ignorance is bliss. We don't want to know. We don't really care, because if to protect Israeli lives, Palestinians have to wait in lines at checkpoints, or they have to suffer, or they have to be locked in cages, well, we trust our security people and they know what they're doing. So if they invade Palestinian homes in the middle of the night and pull people out of their beds and arrest them, if 800,000 Palestinians have been in Israeli prisons, who cares, as long as we're safe and protected? We live in a bubble, particularly people who live in Tel Aviv. You're outside the conflict. Life is good here. Life in Israel is good. Israel's a great country to live in most of the time. Family values, closeness, the informality of the society, the relatively strong economy. Let's face it, we have a good life. We do. And we don't have to deal with the conflict. Palestinians can't avoid the conflict. It's part of their everyday existence. Even if you live in the economic bubble of Ramallah, Ramallah is surrounded by all sides, by settlements and army bases. Ramallah is a big cage. It's a big cage where a lot of economic development is taking place, but it's a cage. And Palestinians live it and feel it, and they know it. They can't avoid the conflict. They see settlements above their houses every day. We don't live that, unless you're a settler, and then you feel it because you're living over there in the Palestinian areas and you're traveling on roads where there are Palestinians traveling. But for the normal Israeli, we turn a blind eye and we go on living our happy lives.
So what do you think the average Israeli Jew or Israeli Arab should be doing at this moment to be part of a solution?
There's a kind of irony here that we have to recognize first. People say it, and people in the government had said it. When it's quiet, we don't have to do anything because it's quiet. And when they're shooting us or stabbing us, we can't do anything with them because they're shooting and stabbing us. So there's this kind of excuse on both ways that we don't have to do anything. I think that we have a responsibility, everyone has a responsibility here, to search for peace. We all have a way of reaching out today with Facebook. There's a way of opening. I tell people, listen, you can get onto the social media and argue with these people till the end of days. What does it achieve? Scoring points? Is scoring points on the internet? If you're serious about wanting to understand, turn to someone randomly on Facebook. If you can't find them, come to my Facebook page. I have 500 friends and thousands of followers. You can find Palestinians there. Knock on their door on Facebook and say, hey, I want to listen to you. I want to understand you. Tell me what you're fighting about. Tell me about your life. But don't start a conversation by arguing and scoring points and you're wrong and I'm right. There's a conflict here. There's more than one narrative. Even if you don't believe their narrative, they believe it. You have to deal with the legitimacy of their narrative as they perceive it. So reach out and try and understand. Listen. I don't know anyone in the world who doesn't want to tell their story. And if you ask someone, tell me your story, tell me what it's about for you, tell me what your life is like, you'll find people who will open up and begin talking. And then you begin to develop a little bit of understanding, compassion, empathy. And it can happen both ways. That's what every single person here can do. We can be active participants in trying to find solutions.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you to Gershon Baskin for taking the time to speak with me. If you have any thoughts or reactions to what he said, please share them on Shtetl's Facebook page or directly on the episode post at www.shtetlmontreal.com. We've still got time for music, so here are a few songs from my October Jerusalem playlist. Please go to shtetlmontreal.com for a full list of all the songs on today's show. And thanks for tuning in to Shtetl on the Shortwave on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal, your home for alternative Jewish arts and culture. This first song is by a Tel Aviv-based band called The Angel Sea.
Your bones are aching with desire to leave this place and find yourself a higher ground to stand on, a higher ground to stand on. And you look very nice, I don't wanna think twice, I just wanna be with you. And in the dark we move through days of hunger, we hungry hearts, we feed each other, we see through all we've lost, through all we've lost. My tears shine in your eyes, from the same dirt we rise, I just wanna be with you.
In Jerusalem, and you are listening to Shtetl on the Shortwave.
Thank you. We'll be right back. This is Shai Ben Tzur, and you're listening to Shtetl on the Shortwave on CKUT.